Thanks for coming along tonight, where Senator Don Farrell makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. He was last here a couple of years ago. I'll introduce him very briefly because he's well known to you, Senator the Honourable Don Farrell. He was elected initially to the Senate in 2007, defeated in 2013, returned in 2016, and I think in 2022, right? And he was a minister in the previous Labor government, but more importantly, in recent times, the Minister for Trade, a very important portfolio, and the Deputy Leader of the Government in the Senate. And the Minister's going to talk for us tonight on the topic, Australia's trade agenda, including China. Senator Farrell, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Gerard, and thank Anne as well. And thank you all for coming along this evening. This is, in fact, the second time I've addressed this August organisation. And it's the only time I've ever been invited back by any organisation to talk to them again. So I do feel very privileged, Gerard. I'm an avid reader of your column, and not that I agree with everything you say, but what I do love is two things, your forensic approach to journalism, and I only wish some of your colleagues in that newspaper that you write for did the same, but your iconoclastic approach to journalism, which I actually think we need a little bit more of in this country. So thank you very much for coming along. I do see my good friend, I'll call you that if it doesn't embarrass you, former Premier O'Farrell. I was sitting on a polling booth in Glenbrook when I first met Premier O'Farrell. He wasn't Premier then. The names are very similar, O'Farrell, Farrell. And after some discussion, we discovered that when both of our great-grandparents left Ireland, they were both called O'Farrell. When mine got to Australia, of course, Adelaide, being not all that friendly to the Irish, my great-grandfather dropped his O and became Farrell. The Premier's great-grandfather, he also dropped the O, but his grandfather understood that the name was in fact O'Farrell and he changed it back. Can you believe it? So that's a great testament to you. When can I let you into a little secret? The opposition was a bit critical of some comments I made about the interrelationship between Australia and the United States and New Zealand, which attracted some comment for a few days. But I was, in fact, at the Irish Embassy that night and said, look, our closest allies really aren't the United States or New Zealand, it's the Irish. But I don't know whether Gerard's serious about me going back over that, but if we... they're nodding at the back. OK. So I was at the Glenbrook... Glenbrook... having trouble with this, aren't we? Polling booth. I bumped into my good friend, soon-to-be Premier O'Farrell, and we discovered that both of our relatives had been O'Farrells when they left Ireland. Both of them, our great-grandparents, changed their name to Farrell, but the Premier's grandfather changed the name back. When the opposition wanted to insult me in the Senate, of course, they call me O'Farrell. And I'm supposed to be upset by that, but of course I'm not. That's my real name. But look, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to talk. And when I first came to talk to you, it was the very early days of the new government. And of course we did have great ambitions in the trade space, and I'm pleased to say that
I can report to you that we've made very significant progress in the almost 2 years since we came to government on trade. And I think we have a, without boasting, my mum used to say, self-praise is no recommendation. But I think, you know, I think we have made significant progress in the trade space. And I want to talk to you about that, about some of the things we've done, some of the things we still have to do, because the job is far from finished. I would also like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land on which we meet and pay respects to the elders past and present. Again, thank you to the Sydney Institute for inviting me to speak. As I said, this is only the first time I've ever been invited back. And congratulations to the Institute for reaching a milestone of 35 years in public office, public affairs, I should say. And it was a very different place back in 1989 when the Institute was established. I had just lost my first attempt at Parliament, the 1988 Adelaide by-election, where Bob Hawke helpfully announced timed telephone calls a few days before the election, and well, that was the end of what I thought was my political career, but politics is so strange. I'm still back here. Anyway, Bob Hawke was Prime Minister and the Australian economy was just starting to open to the world. Our exports back then totaled $35 billion and our imports were around $40 billion. Of course, that left us with a negative terms of trade. One of the things I think is helpful to observe over the last couple of years, of course, is that our terms of trade have been very much in our favour. In fact, our terms of trade have never been as good in my lifetime as they have been over the last couple of years. And we can thank Tanya Constable's organisation very much for the wonderful contribution that they have made to getting us to that position. So both in terms of volume and value, our trade has never ever been better in my lifetime. And today, Australia's two-way trade has expanded to around $1 trillion. So starting at $35 billion 35 years ago, our two-way trade is now $1 trillion. It's fair to say that the opening of our economy sets us on a path to greater prosperity. The economic reforms from the Hawke-Keating Labor government in the 80s and 90s was then and still is the right path to take. It positioned Australia well to take full advantage of the global opportunities created by the outcomes of the Uruguay round of trade negotiations and the establishment of the World Trade Organization back in 1995. So we fast forward to 2024 and trade continues to be a force for good in addressing Australia's current and future economic challenges. One in four Australian jobs are related to trade. Jobs in export industries pay at least 5% more on average than non-trade related jobs, and 27% of Australians' economic output is supported by trade. This evening, I want to talk about the Albanese Labor government's approach to trade policy and how we are delivering outcomes for businesses, for workers, and everyday Australians in this space. In particular, I'll cover the economic engagement with China, India, Southeast Asia, and very soon, the United Arab Emirates. On China, when we came to government, our bilateral relationship was in a very different place. China's trade impediments, that's the word we use, impediments, were affecting a range of Australian exports worth over $20 billion. And if you think about that, total two-way trade with China last year was $299 billion, far and away ahead of any other country. And yet, even at that level, we had $20 billion worth of trade impediments. The political level dialogue had broken down, and it was the objective of the incoming government, and partly the job that the Prime Minister gave me, was to reverse that breakdown in the relationship. The relationship needed stabilising in the interests of both both countries. And over the past 2 years, that stabilisation is exactly what the Albanese government has done. We've acknowledged our differences, but we seek to manage those differences wisely and always act in Australia's national interest. I've now met my Chinese counterpart, Wang Wentao, 6 times now, and have pressed for all trade impediments to be removed. The first of those meetings was a Skype, Teams meeting. It's funny how things give you the wrong appearance. I thought he was about the same height as me, just based on the Teams photos. When I met him, of course, he's about a foot taller than me. And so when we were going up some stairs at, in Beijing, I had to always be one or two steps ahead of him. Otherwise, he would tower over me like that. And I didn't want to create that impression. Now, since the day I took the job as the Trade Minister, I've sought to resolve trade issues by dialogue rather than disputation. That hasn't always been a popular view in this country, and you can even today read reports about maybe that's not the right direction. But in 45 years in public office, I believe discussion was a better way to go than disputation. And I think we can see now the benefits of that constructive engagement. And of course, over only 10 days ago, China announced that all imports on Australian bottled wine would be lifted. Just remembering that those tariffs were 220% on Australian wine, a huge tariff. I did say to Jared that and Anne that I wasn't going to come back and address this group until such time I had the tariffs lifted. And very pleasingly, the timing worked out just nicely. And since 2020, China's duties on Australian wine had effectively made it unviable for Australian producers to export bottled wine to that market. And this outcome paves the way for Australian producers and exporters to again supply our world-class wine to Chinese consumers. There's already wine on its way back into to China. Anticipating the lifting of the bans, a lot of Australian companies re-established their links with their Chinese counterparts. It's true that wine consumption has dropped in China. One of the reasons, of course, it's dropped is they haven't had access to Australian wine. And yes, that's right. And of course, those Australian producers know that they've got a great market there, and they're about to start supplying once again. Of course, I know firsthand that Chinese consumers are eager to buy our wines. But the reason I know that is because the Chinese Trade Minister told me that. And of course, who can blame them? One of my favourite wines is Grange, but not from my birth year. that wasn't too embarrassing, was it? So this is the latest example of how our calm and consistent approach is delivering for Australian businesses, workers and exporters. So we started, in the case of China, with a $20 billion worth of trade impediments by 2019 figures. and that's now been reduced to less than $1 billion. So the job's not finished. And of course, we want the figure to be reduced to zero. To try and put that $20 billion into some perspective, of course, one of the things I haven't yet succeeded in doing is get a free trade agreement with the European Union. The total value of the offer from the European Union on beef and sheep meat was $1 billion. So we have got an agreement with them, but in that same two-year period, we've managed to get $20 billion worth of trade back into China. And of course, if you have a look at some of the figures, particularly things like barley, coal, we're actually selling now more of those products into the China market than we were pre the impediments. So the government continues to press for the removal of the remaining trade impediments on mock lobster, and there's about four Australian abattoirs who've not managed to get their product back into China. But bear in mind this, we're now selling more meat into China than we were pre the bans. So meat is actually, by and large, a positive story. The fact is, China is our largest trading partner and will remain so for the foreseeable future. But that's not to say we can't continue to grow opportunities for Australian businesses, reopening these markets in China, as well as expanding other markets. So we have a diversification policy. That doesn't mean selling less into China, because of course my objective over the last couple of years is to sell more. But what it does mean is expanding into other markets, so we're never again reliant on a single market the way we have been in the past. And as a government, we've been encouraging businesses and exporters to diversify their trade into new markets. Of course, we've concluded two new agreements, one with India, and can I say what a terrific role the Premier played in that exercise, and the more recent visit of myself and the Prime Minister to India, and to the United Kingdom. The Indian market is one of the fastest growing in the world and home to 1.4 billion people. They're now the largest population of the world. And when you think about India, they're now our largest source of migrants, our largest source of tourists, and our largest source of students, tourists, and migrants. So it's a really important market for us. And the Albanese government fast-tracked the legislation to bring the Australia Trade Agreement into force by the end of 2022, which gave us one extra reduction in tariffs because of that. The agreement itself eliminates tariffs on more than 85% of Australian exports to India and gives Australian exporters a competitive advantage in the Indian market. Trade figures for the first 12 months of this trade agreement show that Australia's exports rose by 35%, industrial exports rose by 35%, and agricultural exports by almost 60%. And when I was recently in India, both myself and the Indian Trade Minister Goyal committed to getting our trade to $100 billion by the end of the decade. And I'm confident that two-way trade will continue to grow well into the future. Deeper engagement with Southeast Asia is also a key priority of the Albanese government. Too often we've flown over Southeast Asia to East Asia. We can't do that anymore. We've got to engage with Southeast Asia. And of course, last month we hosted in Melbourne a terrific ASEAN Australia special summit. Every single leader in Southeast Asia intended, except from Myanmar. So that's, I think, an expression of just how successful that meeting was. There were some incredible announcements to come out of the summit, which will supercharge our trade and investment in Southeast Asia. We're establishing a $2 billion Southeast Asia investment financing facility to accelerate Australian investment in key sectors such as infrastructure and clean energy. We've got regional landing pads and investment deal teams in Jakarta, Ho Chi Minh and Singapore to support our tech sector launch and to facilitate more Australian trade and investment in this fast-growing region. Just to give you one example, when I was married in the Philippines in 40 years ago, two things. Ferdinand Marcos was president, and today Ferdinand Marcos is president. But more significantly, the population was 60 million. It's now 120 million. So, and an economy that's growing as fast, if not faster, than China. And now we have the new Southeast Asia Business Exchange Program to get more Australian boots on the ground and learn what it takes to export into this into these dynamic markets. There's just a few things we're doing to deepen our ties with Southeast Asia. ASEAN as a bloc is going to be the world's fourth biggest economy by 2040. And of course, as I said before, we're underdone in Southeast Asia. We see ASEAN not only as an enormous growth opportunity for Australian businesses, but also as a key destination to diversify our trade, both for imports and exports. And looking further afield, last year the Albanese government made the decision to negotiate a trade agreement with the United Arab Emirates. They're our largest trade and investment partner in the Middle East, and of course have huge sovereign wealth funds. When I visited Abu Dhabi in February to attend the World Trade Organization's 13th Ministerial Conference, I met with senior ministers and business representatives of the UAE to progress negotiations and promote stronger investment ties. The UAE is the gateway to the Middle East, and a trade agreement would open up a new commercially meaningful opportunities for our businesses and our exporters seeking to diversify trade. It will also unlock massive opportunities to deepen our cooperation in our shared ambition to transition to net zero through greater investment. Both sides are committed to progressing the negotiations as swiftly as possible. I'm reluctant to make predictions, because whatever predictions I make generally don't come to pass. What I've discovered about being in government is that things do take a lot longer than you expect them to, and very often are harder. But I would like to see a free trade agreement up and running with the United Arab Emirates by the end of this year. I think we can do that before the next election. And both sides are committed to progressing the negotiations as swiftly as possible. In summary, the government's message to business is that you should continue to diversify your markets, and we'll help you to do that through our Austrade representatives and these new people that we're sending into Southeast Asia, and to take advantage of some of the great opportunities provided by the trade agreements. I've always believed that Australia is a great trading nation, and the future of our country, our economy and our prosperity depends on trade. So thank you, and I'm happy to take any questions.
So we come, many thanks to the Minister for an important address tonight, and so we come to questions and discussion. If I can get a microphone for the front here. So can I just lead off? If you come back and go on this side of me, I'm sorry. All right, so you come back here.
On the right.
Pretty well. Pretty well staying.
Extreme right.
Pretty well staying. Pretty well. You just come out.
Oh, pretty well.
There we go. Okay. Early on in your talk, you spoke possibly about the contribution of the mining industry to Australia and the current economic state of Australia, the good economic state of Australia. And you've spoken a bit about Australia trading with the world, including China, and you mentioned other countries. What about concerning other countries about our capacity to trade? Because, as you know, I think Japan has expressed concern that opposition to Australia in certain areas, such as gas and other coal exports, could be problematic for the Japanese economy. I think the South Koreans have expressed similar concern. So that's not opposition coming from within the government, but is opposition coming from within Australian society? How are you handling that?
Very well, Jared. Japanese ambassador is coming out to the Clear Valley in a few weeks' time. Of course, he very much appreciates the wonderful food and wine that we have to offer in that region. And if anybody hasn't visited out there, I can highly recommend the Clear Valley. I was up in IMPEX last week and visited the IMPEX facility in Darwin. I actually presented the first chair of IMPEX, Mr. Kitamura, with an Australian honour in Japan, which was extremely well received. What I say to all of the countries since we've come to government is this. We haven't failed to deliver on 1 kilojoule of gas or coal or iron ore since we've come to government. In other words, this government has met every single commercial obligation that we have been required to make, but more importantly, we'll continue to do that. And so whether you're a Japanese company or Japanese government, whether you're South Korean government or business, or for that matter, whether you're the Chinese government or business, we will continue to comply and carry through on every single agreement this country has made. Now, it is true that on coming to government that we did find that we had to make some hard decisions to ensure that, particularly in Sydney, this beautiful city, this most beautiful city in the country, kept its lights on, had enough gas to ensure that it kept the lights on. So we had to make some difficult decisions that we would have preferred not to make. Now, I don't want to be too political about that, but the former government had 9 years to ensure that we didn't get into a situation where there were shortages of gas in this country. So it is a little bit rich for people to say, oh, well, this is suddenly a problem and we had to deal with it. We dealt with it the only way we can, the only way we could, which was to ensure that we protected our national interests, we ensured that Australians continued to be able to turn the lights on, but at the same time, we honoured every single commercial agreement that we were obliged to honour, and we'll continue to do that.
Barry. Minister, congratulations on what you've done, particularly in stabilising and reopening trade with China. And no doubt amongst your weaponry, again, was Farrell wine produce, which you took to India.
I'm not supposed to
which
say
is, which is not a huge consumer, but they all enjoyed it. So, but my question goes back to something you said earlier, correctly, that the economic reforms of the Hawke-Keating government helped set Australia up at a time when China was first opening up and when we started to grow our economy. Just to echo Jared for a moment, a lot of that was delivered with the support of the Liberal National parties. As the deputy leader in the Senate, what chance do we have of replicating that sort of bipartisanship on major economic reforms for the future?
Thank you. Thank you. And that's an excellent question, Premier. Just a couple of things. When I went to China for the first time, they showed me a photograph of the first Australian Trade Minister who had ever gone to China 50 years earlier. What was interesting was some of the names of the companies that he took 20 companies with him, including Coles and Myer, who were then two separate companies. But guess who the Trade Minister was? It was Jim Cairns. And I thought to myself, there couldn't be a greater contrast of Labor members of Parliament than Jim or myself, but we were both trying to do the same thing, which was increase trade with China. Can I say, I've been delighted in my space with the support I've had from the coalition. I don't think I could have wanted for more support, whether I've had to make tough decisions like rejecting the EU free trade offer or opening up to UK, India, China, Southeast Asia. So I think in my space, I am actually very lucky that there is bipartisan support. And I won't name the particular individuals, but when the wine thing came through, I was overwhelmed with messages of support and thanks from the coalition. So I think, at least in this space, things are going very well, and they should. My portfolios, trade, tourism and special minister of state, which is electoral reform, they should be areas where there should be cooperation and consultation between the major parties. But in the broader scheme of things, I think Jim Chalmers does his absolute best to try and get cooperation on these things. I know the Prime Minister would prefer to get things through by agreement. We just have to persevere. As we've done with China, you know, we didn't fix the wine issue overnight. It took us almost 2 years, but we did fix it. With these other changes, we have to do the best to explain what we're doing. And sure, we'd love to have coalition support. Anything you can do, of course, to help in that regard would be most appreciated.
Okay, so there's a question here. There's one up the back, I think.
Yes.
Go to speak right
into
the microphone.
Thank you, Minister. Comes on. Thank you, Minister. I'm Runika from Japanese media, Nikkei. And after China lifted tariffs on Australian wine, I am curious about Australia's standing on China's participation on CPTPP. While an aspirant economy needs to meet the high standard, and it is a consensus issue. As an individual member of the trade pact, would you support China's participation? And as both China and Taiwan request for the establishment of an accession working group, are we close to see any establishment?
Thank you for that question. It's a very good question. That agreement used to be called the TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership. It's now called the CPTPP as a result of Canada's accession to the arrangement. So it is a very difficult set of initials to pronounce. Every time I meet my Chinese counterpart, they do raise the issue of accession to the CPTPP. The answer that I give them, and I think this is the answer that all countries would give them, is that the requirement under the CPTPP is consensus. So if you're going to add another country, and there's six or seven countries to seeking admission, you've mentioned two of them, China and Taiwan, but Costa Rica is one, Ukraine is another, and there's a number of other countries that are seeking admission. The obligation is to consult and consensus. So Australia doesn't act independently of all of the countries in that group. We acting in concert with them. We have just added the United Kingdom to the list of countries in that agreement. neither the United Kingdom or Australia have completed our processes to add the UK to that agreement. I don't know, just off the top of my head, I think six or seven countries have to give approval before they are technically admitted to that group. And that process is still working. So we haven't actually completed the processes to admit the last applicant into the CPTPP, even though we have agreed to introduce them. So the first observation I'd make is there's got to be consensus. Secondly, we're still only now working through the processes of the last applicant. Reading the room at our last meeting of CPTPP members, I think there's a sense that we'll settle down the United Kingdom, and then we will determine what the process for the accession of any additional countries might be. So I think there is a process. We'll follow that process, and we'll work out in the consultation with our fellow countries just how we're going to add additional countries to that agreement.
Minister, you spoke about a free trade agreement with the EU and how you're working on it. And only today, one of our members who's travelling in Europe was asking me to ask you why he sees in the Netherlands, Austria, Hungary, so much beef from Argentina and not Australia, et cetera, et cetera. So how's it going with the EU?
Look, it's very hard work. In all my 45 years in public life, I've never found a more difficult task than negotiating a free trade agreement with the European Union. I do say this, though, that if it was easy to do, then somebody else would have done it a long time ago. And the fact that nobody has done it is an indication that this is a difficult application. In the whole time that the current government, that's the current European government, has been in place, they have only negotiated one free trade agreement, and that is with New Zealand. And the Prime Minister who negotiated that is no longer there. The Trade Minister who was involved in that negotiation, a good friend of mine, Michael O'Connor, he's no longer there. I don't say there's any link between those two things, but they will tell you that they were not happy with the outcome of those negotiations. And point number one, I was determined that if we were going to reach an agreement, I wanted to be happy with it, and I wanted Australia to be happy with it. We were never going to simply negotiate an agreement for the sake of it, to say, look, we've got an agreement. It had to be the right agreement, and some of the well-publicised issues that we weren't able to achieve movement on are still yet to be resolved. Now, when we met in Osaka last year to have further negotiations that fell over, we both committed, myself and Minister Dombrovskis, continued to say we would continue to negotiate. I met with him a few weeks ago in Abu Dhabi, and he's reiterated that both of us would like to continue the negotiations. So the negotiations are not off. They're still capable of being progressed. The European elections are on in a couple of weeks. you might have noticed that in both France and Belgium, French farmers are protesting about exactly what you say, appearance of Argentinian beef on the supermarket shelves. Just imagine if we'd added all of the Australian beef to what they might be saying in the lead up to that election. Will it be easier or I don't think much progress will will be made between now and the election, so it'll be post-election. They then have a system where they potentially rotate all of the ministers. So the person I've been negotiating with may not be the relevant minister. But I've got a good personal relationship with him. He likes my wine from South Australia, like the Chinese minister, like the, I won't go through all of that. So look, the potential is there, but can I say this? Only a couple of weeks after our agreement fell over, Mercosur, the agreement which would bring in more Argentinian and Brazilian meat into EU, also fell over. So the issues that we're struggling with, access of our beef and sheep meat in particular, there's some other issues, don't get me wrong, they're not the sole issues, but Other countries are having exactly the same problem that we're having.
You may be aware of this, but around 1976, Malcolm Fraser appointed John Howard as Minister for Special Trade Negotiations to deal with the EU. He was at it for about 3 months. It was the worst job he ever had in his life.
Well, there we go.
Couldn't get anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Look, I haven't given up. And just as people say, oh, no, you'll never get wine back into China, well, we have. And, you know, but you've just got to be, to persevere, and it takes two to tango. They genuinely want a free trade agreement.
Question at the back.
Good evening, Minister. Thank you very much, and congratulations on resolving the China issue with wine tariffs. I just know from dealing with our Chinese friends that they don't really give very much away for free. So I'm wondering, if we got the wine tariffs lifted, what did we give them in return?
Nothing.
Congratulations. Just love and affection. Okay, there's a question here. You need a microphone?
Minister, can you tell us a bit more about the World Trade Organization and where that fits in? Because you've just focused mostly on bilateral arrangements and that sort.
Yeah, so look, and that's a very good question, and it has some quite dramatic implications for Australia if the World Trade Organization doesn't succeed. Now, we talked earlier about the CPTPP. In its earlier iteration, it was the TPP. That became a political issue in the 2016 American presidential elections. And although it was a creature of the Obama government, by the end of the election cycle, both Donald Trump, who called the agreement a monstrosity, and Hillary, who'd been Secretary of State when that agreement was being negotiated, both abandoned the Trans-Pacific Partnership. We're trying to re-engage the in trade issues through the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework, and I'm hoping in a couple of weeks to go to Singapore to sign the next two pillars of that agreement, but it won't include a trade pillar. As soon as Donald Trump became president, he sought to ensure that the World Trade Organization did not have the ability to deal with appeals. So, for instance, if we had continued with our World Trade Organization dispute over wine and we'd won it, then there would have been an opportunity for, under the old days, China to appeal that decision. By refusing to appoint judges to the appellate court, Donald Trump effectively neutered the appeal process in the World Trade Organization. In Abu Dhabi a few weeks ago, we tried to make some progress on resolving some of those issues. We didn't succeed then, although the understanding is that discussions will continue. It's very much in Australia's interest to have a functioning World Trade Organization that can deal with any sort of trade dispute. We haven't given up. We'll continue to advocate for that. We've got many allies in that process, but if I'm perfectly honest with you, I think until we know the outcome of the American elections, probably not very much progress is going to be made on resolving those outstanding issues.
Question down the back.
Minister, Dave McCready, former CEO of the British Chamber, and we had you twice at the Chamber, so we definitely invited you back when I was there.
No, I was thinking, think tanks.
No, that's fine. That's fine. Just wanted to point that out. But obviously, I still have a strong UK bent in my business work now. I'm really interested on your reflections on what's coming up to a year of the free trade agreement coming through with the UK and being in force, and then the provisions that have continued to dribble through as they do. Just your reflections on how it's going at the moment. Are we making enough of it, both here at home as an opportunity to export to, particularly around trade and services, where that's the vast majority of our relationship?
Look, it's been a terrific agreement, the UK trade agreement. Our trade with the UK has already doubled in that first 12 months. It has been more favourable to Australia up until this point than the United Kingdom, but they intend to catch up. And I recently had a chat with Kemi Badenoch, my equivalent in the UK system, and they're very determined to ensure that they get as much value out of that agreement as we get. I think the opportunities are there. To do more, and as we express our desire to diversify our trading relationship, then UK presents wonderful opportunities. We sent our first shipment of sugar since 1972, 40,000 tonnes of sugar from Australia to the UK. If that's any indication of the potential, then I think we can do very well out of it. There is criticism of the Conservative government in UK that the deal was too much in Australia's favour. I think it was a fair agreement, and I think people have unjustly criticised it. If there's a change of government in the UK later this year or early next year, then I think we will see a continuation of a willingness to try and expand the trade agreement. So I'm very positive about the UK agreement. One of the things that the Europeans said to me about not being able to offer any more beef or sheep meat, they said, you're already taking our markets in the UK. So, you know, you're already getting a benefit out of a free trade agreement. But no, as a government, we will continue to work to expand. Build those links. They're already obviously strong already, but we can do more.
Minister, can you expand on the tantalising mention that you gave of Ukraine in the whole trade agreements, and perhaps even extend to where we're at with Russia?
Well, we continue to ban Russian exports into Australia. With the Ukraine, I mean, we've taken a very strong stand against Russia. With the Ukraine, we continue to support them. And, you know, we've done a number of things, both in a military sense to assist them, but also in a trade sense. So I recently signed an extension of an agreement to lift the tariff on all Ukraine exports into Australia. Now, they're not a lot. We don't have. We tend to be a competitors in the world scene rather than complementary. So we don't do a lot of trade. But if they wish to, as they do, to join the CPTPP, then of course. We will treat them just like we're treating all of the other countries that would like to join. my daughter just got engaged, and I was on the steps of the Adelaide Parliament House with all of the Ukrainian people, and I was able to announce I have a special relationship with Ukraine because my youngest daughter is marrying a very fine fellow from the Ukraine. So we have obviously a very close interest in that country, and we'll continue, just in my space, the trade space, we'll continue to do whatever we can to boost our trade and do the best for the people of Ukraine.
One of our members who couldn't be here tonight asked me to ask you about what happens when you negotiate with the Chinese trade. I know you said he's taller, but are you speaking in the same language? Do you go through translators? Is that a problem? How do you do it?
Well, I don't speak Mandarin. There's not that many Labour politicians that do. The ones that do are, of course, very famous people. So I don't speak Mandarin. In fact, it's interesting. The daughter I mentioned to is just marrying this young Ukrainian fella. When she went to school, she did learn Chinese. A place that you would know, the Adelaide Central Market, Jacqueline, she went in there to try out her Mandarin with all of the Chinese traders in Chinatown at the Central Market, only to find that they were all from Hong Kong and only spoke Cantonese. small problem. We always speak through an interpreter, a very good interpreter, who's with us all of the time. I'm not sure if he understands English, but it's a very free-flowing conversation with him, and I'm never left in any doubt about what he's telling me, and I don't believe he's left in any doubt about what I'm telling him. So, it's through interpreters, but it's a very good, a free-flowing exchange of views in every conversation, whether it's been over Teams. We've only had one Teams meeting, I think. The rest of them have all been face-to-face meetings, and they've all been, very positive meetings.
We're getting close to the end. Have I missed anyone around the place?
Yes, very brief. This is not so much a question as an answer to one of the comments here. I did a calculation to increase the trade from $30 billion in 1988 to $1 trillion today is a multiple of about 30 odd times. And that gives you a compound annual growth rate of 10.5%. Now, if you adjust it for inflation, reduce it by 3 or so, that gives you about 7.5%. That's a spectacular performance, absolutely spectacular. It goes to show how good it is to have an open economy.
Okay, but you've got to reduce time too.
And the second comment, one of the answers there, the question was, what did we give the Chinese in return? Well, I know what we gave the Chinese.
Okay, I think we've covered that. Okay.
Have we?
Yes. Right. The first question was some mathematical equation that I couldn't quite understand, but you're the trade minister, so...
Well, I think we take it as a compliment and say thank you very much.
Can I ask, is it because of our mineral exports? I mean, what has made it so dramatically increased? Because if it's a sterling performance, maybe it's to do with our deregulation of the economy, or is it because we're booming in minerals?
Minerals is a very big part of, firstly the volume, but also the value and the price we're getting for our products. But it's not just minerals. When I made my first visit to Beijing in this capacity, you go through a Chinese supermarket and it's full of Australian goods. Despite the fact that they've, had impediments on $20 billion worth of goods, Cooper's beer was in there.
Bundaberg,
yes, Bundaberg, yes. I was thinking Berenberg when I looked at that, and it was Bundaberg I was trying to say. Our beef, even though we've had some impediments with beef, we're still getting huge amounts of beef into China. baby products, massive products, health products. Massive. So it's not to get to that $300 billion. It's not just minerals, but minerals are obviously a very important part of that process. But my view about the Chinese economy and the Chinese consumer is they'll take even more of our products. So the figure you're talking about of that growth, we can do even better than that in China.
The final question, if you were to come back in 3 years, assuming you win the next election, What do you think you
of course we're going to win the next election.
Okay. You won the next election. What do you think you'd be saying that was different to what you've said tonight? I mean, what other initiatives do you hope to achieve in the medium to short term?
Look, I haven't given up on the European one. But as I say, it's difficult, and it will require a better offer for us to accept. I'd love to be able to sign the trade pillar with the United States. The United States are our great ally. We need them in this region to be trading, and we need them to make further advancements on the Indo-Pacific economic framework. I'd love to see our trade with Southeast Asia double or triple. Doesn't matter which country you look at in Southeast Asia, whether it's India, whether it's the Philippines, whether it's Thailand, whether it's Vietnam. There's a massive transition from agricultural workers to the middle class. If we just look at wine, everywhere else in the world where that transition has occurred, people have moved from spirits and beer to wine. So there's great opportunities there just in wine alone for us to make improvements. We just have to open our horizon. There's wonderful opportunities right on our doorstep here. We have to take advantage of them.
Many thanks.
So at the Sydney Institute, we're grateful for tonight, and we're very fortunate. Cabinet ministers are very busy ministers, very busy people, and the Deputy Leader of the Government and the Senate is a particularly busy person in addition to being Minister for Trade. So the Minister's come along tonight, given us an important speech for close to 30 minutes, taken over half an hour questions and discussion. That's a terrific effort, and it just shows what a fine democracy this country is. And we'll congratulate you for tonight, and we'd love to have you back next time.